MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Our distinguished guest today is Larry Pfeiffer, who held several very high-level positions in U.S. intelligence, including Chief of Staff to CIA Director Michael Hayden in the early 2000s and as Senior Director of the White House Situation Room. Larry's been here with us before. He's a great talker, and we're really looking forward to having a conversation about Tulsi Gabbard and all that mess that's going on right now. But what's on your mind, you guys?
Well, I have been obsessed with the Tulsi Gabbard story and really eager to talk to Larry Pfeiffer about this. I mean, among other high-level positions he held, he was chief of staff at the CIA for several years. So he is deeply immersed in the intelligence community world. And, you know, what we've seen, and this is a continuing story with Tulsi Gabbard and her meddling in Fulton County, Georgia, with the FBI seizure of election ballots. Gabbard, we're going to talk about this, but, you know, Gabbard asserted and left the clear impression this was all about foreign interference in Fulton County. Somehow foreign governments, the Chinese, the Iranians, we don't know who was manipulating the vote count in Fulton County. That was the clear impression she left, and that's why she was there. And this week, as we will talk to Larry about, the FBI affidavits get unsealed, and there's nothing about foreign interference, the Chinese, the Russians, the Iranians, not a word about it. So
good Lord.
That was what you'd call a major league head fake by the Director of National Intelligence.
Yeah, I don't think we need to revisit the drama that took place with the Pam Bondi hearing. But I do think that it
was pretty astounding.
It was amazing.
It was disgusting.
But, you know, so I'm not going to raise the issue of the independence of the Justice Department, which is something we can talk about, you know, on another episode. But I am worried.
I think that's best said with air quotes, independence of the Justice Department.
Well, the clear lack of independence and the degree to which the adherence and admiration for Donald Trump had to be repeated over and over. But that aside, I think there are issues about the Department of Justice and how it functions nationwide that are really at issue here. And whether we're talking about grand jury indictments that don't get returned as indictments that are just expected to come through, whether we're talking about the insecurity of U.S. attorneys who are in their jobs and how long they're going to be in their jobs and who's going to fire them and what the terms and grounds for their firing are, or many other things, or whether we're talking about prosecutors that are resigning because they are being asked to do things that they can't in good conscience, in adherence to the law and their profession, do. I think there's a real worry about the Department of Justice writ large beyond what we saw with Pam Bondi this week. And I just want to flag that.
You know, the classic line about federal prosecutors is that they can get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich.
That's right. That's
this week, they tried to get a grand jury in Washington, D.C. to indict, six United States senators who made that video saying that service people shouldn't follow illegal orders. And the grand jury refused. And that's not the first time it's happened. In Washington, it's happened repeatedly, where the U.S. attorney, Jeanine Pirro, the former Fox News host, has brought cases and the grand juries have rejected them on multiple occasions. So the mere the competence of the Justice Department
and the professionalism really of it, which is something that we're going to get to in this conversation as well.
And speaking, rounding up with that conversation, wouldn't it have been nice if we had seen a senior Justice Department official show up at Fulton County at the courthouse or at the election center and said to Tulsi Gabbard, "Get out of here. You have no business being here.
Given that the New York Times reporting this week is that Trump explicitly told her to go down to Fulton County and take charge of the investigation. I mean,
well, I don't think she would have needed much
goading. If the President of the
United
States wants her there, who at the Justice Department is going to say otherwise?
Well, as our guest Larry Pfeiffer is going to probably talk about, is that this is just more performative BS by a Trump official. They're all trying to out-scream each other to get the president's attention to stay in his good graces.
Yeah, but Jeff, I'm not sure this is performative. I mean, the game plan
seems to
raise enough questions about the competency of Fulton County to count ballots that, on the first hand, there's something called the Georgia State Election Board, which is now controlled by MAGA people.
Correct.
We'll take over the election in Fulton County, and it'll be a MAGA-run election in Fulton County.
Right, and the further question is this a, you know, is this a test for something else that's going to come? Is this, you know, a testing ground?
And even if there's legal challenges to that and it all gets murked up, you know, what we'll see certainly is the same kind of stop the steal campaign if John Ossoff wins re-election in Georgia this year, key Senate seat, or in some of these congressional races in Georgia. So, you know, they are setting the stage for major league interference in this fall's election, and not just in Georgia. I think this is taking place nationwide.
It's a deja vu all over again. And with the added addition of this clown show with someone who should be a very highly respected head of U.S. intelligence, who's just, I don't know, making a clown out of herself by showing up in Fulton County, among many other things that the sweetheart of the Kremlin has been doing. So with that, we're going to get on to, well, they call her our gal Tulsi on Moscow State TV, you know, so.
Yeah. I don't think we have to go there to make the case that she is completely she is a conspiracy theorist and completely incompetent at her job.
Well, I did.
Yes, you did.
Anyway,
you guys are a riot.
With that, let's get on to our guest, Larry Pfeiffer. We're really looking forward to it. Thank you. Welcome back to Spy Talk, Larry Pfeiffer. As I said in introducing you to our listeners, you worked at the highest levels of U.S. intelligence, including as chief of staff to former CIA Director Michael Hayden and as senior director of the White House Situation Room. But you started your career at the eavesdropping, code-breaking National Security Agency. From that perspective, I'm wondering if you can make an educated guess on whether the professionals at NSA are keeping a close watch or ear on Tulsi Gabbard, considering her controversial relationship with the Russians. I'm thinking right now about her 2024 trip to the Vatican, financed by a pro-Kremlin Belgian businessman with ties to the GRU, the Russian Military Intelligence Agency. But you yourself commented last February that Tulsi Gabbard had a long history of statements that, quote, seemed to come out of the Kremlin's notebook. Is the NSA keeping an ear on Tulsi Gabbard?
Well, as you know, the NSA doesn't spy on Americans.
Right.
So, directly. So if Tulsi Gabbard's popping up on NSA's intercept, it's because she's talking to people that we're targeting and are interested in. So I'll leave it at that. But
well, let's just explain that a little bit. So the NSA is constantly looking for listening to Russian officials or adversary officials. And often, and I reported on how Jane Harman was picked up on one of these NSA taps, so to speak, years ago, discussing arrangements with an Israeli agent. So Tulsi Gabbard could come up in conversations that Russians are having among themselves or with other people here in the United States.
Well, yeah, there may be times where an American is talking to an official. There could be times when foreign officials are talking about an American or talking about a conversation they just had with an American. Mm-hmm. And uh, the uh, As long as there is information of a foreign intelligence value that meets priorities and topics established by the NSC, then that material is reported. But the Americans are protected in a variety of ways. If they're a high-level U.S. official, often their name will be substituted with their title. If they're sort of a mid-level career official, it just may refer to it as very, very generically as a U.S. government official. If it's a private citizen, it'll just say, you know, U.S. person number one, U.S. person number two. That's where when the published report goes out to customers of NSA, that is what they will see. Now, that being said, if a customer of NSA reads a report and says, you know, for me to really better understand the foreign intelligence value of that report, I kind of need to know who that American is. And so they can put a request into NSA. That's the famous, we hear about it in the news about unmasking Americans. You know, they've got to have a legitimate reason. NSA has to adjudicate it. There's only a small number of officials that make those decisions. Often it goes up to the director himself to approve. And so there could be some U.S. officials who will learn the actual identity, but it remains protected in databases and in published reports.
I should point out that the questions about Gabbard are not just about that Vatican trip and ties to the Russians. We, in Spy Talk, after she got nominated, wrote about her 2017 trip to Damascus to meet with Assad, in which she emerged and immediately posted on her social media accounts, essentially Assad, Syrian and Russian talking points that Assad was fighting terrorists, and those were the real danger in Syria, not the brutal regime. But I want to, Larry, ask you about the more recent developments down in Fulton County, Georgia. Her extraordinary presence in that for that FBI seizure of voting records at the end of January, a couple weeks ago. This week, and after that, she wrote a letter to members of Congress explaining why she had gone down to Fulton County. She said the president asked her to. That does appear now to be true. But she presented it as a national security issue. This was an issue of intelligence, foreign influence in the elections, and that was why she was there. This week, the FBI affidavit behind the search got released, and there's not a word about foreign meddling in Fulton County, Georgia. What do you make of that?
Well, putting aside any of that, what I would like to emphasize up front is that the U.S. intelligence community is an outrageously powerful and outrageously secretive organization. There's nothing that Americans hate more than secrecy and powerful institutions. And so the intel community, since at least the 1970s, has been assiduous in trying to make sure that there's a bright line between their foreign intelligence mission and domestic law enforcement activity. There's actually law that prevents CIA, for example, from being involved in any domestic operation. So for her to go and participate in something as discreet as the execution of a search warrant on an election-related facility, just is not the wisest thing for someone to do in that position, because it just automatically raises questions amongst many people in this country as to what they're up to and what are we using our intelligence community for. And so that, to me, is the greatest and gravest sin that she committed there. Now, getting into your question, you know, let's make it even more complicated to get a search warrant that doesn't indicate any nexus with foreign intelligence. So now you really have to ask yourself, well, okay, why was she there, and why did she lie to Congress about her reasons for being there? I think we know the answer to that question. We have seen that she goes through episodes of falling out of favor with the president, not being involved in important discussions like, are we going to go and kidnap the president of Venezuela, and needs to do something to get back in his favor. And so she curries that favor by releasing and declassifying sensitive intelligence, making up tales about Barack Obama being behind some grand conspiracy to put out bad intelligence.
Treasonous conspiracy was the phrase she used to describe what Obama had done.
So she does these things in his favor. You see then reports about how he's so happy with her. He makes public statements about what a great job she's doing, and she can march on. It's doing a lot of damage, I think, to the credibility of the intelligence community overall. It's leading august opinion writers like David Ignatius to go out and say, maybe we ought to do away with that DNI thing because she's doing such a bad job. Not helpful.
I will point out just one more beat on that unsealing of the FBI affidavit, because the only publicly identified source who triggered the investigation is a guy by the name of Kurt Olson, who was a Stop the Steal election denier in 2020, was Mike Lindell, the pillow guy's lawyer in multiple cases involving the 2020 election, and was sanctioned by two judges for submitting inaccurate information in court documents. And so you have this conspiracy theorist who triggered the whole operation. By the way, I should add, Trump then installed Kurt Olson into an office in the White House called the Election Security Office, or, you know, some such. And Olson then referred made the referral to the FBI for the investigation into Fulton County. So you have
totally bonkers,
well-documented sanctioned conspiracy theorist who triggers the whole thing. And then Tulsi Gabbard, a conspiracy theorist on her own, jumps on. Having somebody with that sort of mindset as the top intelligence official in the government, I mean...
Well, let's also not forget that Olson has apparently, the president has ordered the intelligence community to provide him with intelligence reporting about the election. So here's an individual who was sanctioned by judges for lying to the court, and we are granting him access to some of the most sensitive intelligence that we have. Somebody sanctioned by court for lying is not someone that I would normally expect would get an intelligence security clearance to access sensitive intelligence. So that's a little frightening. That's probably a thread worth pulling. Was there actually, I think there's actually been, the DNI office came out and said, you know, that he passed his polygraph and, you know, he had a background investigation and was given access. I'd love for someone on the intelligence committees to pull that thread real hard to see what the results of those investigations were, and were there concerns raised that were then ignored or dismissed? Yeah.
I have a bunch of questions, but I just want to start with, you know, it seems to be that there's just more than one official within the intelligence community that seems to be either not trained for the job they have, tied in the past to Tulsi Gabbard in one way or another. So my real question is, you know, we could talk about, you know, unearthing information on this person, that person, or the other person. I don't think there's a lot of trust right now in the IG because of what's happened recently. Where do you see this going in terms of institutional ability to correct this damage? So that's my first question. Then I have a follow-on one.
So it's doing a lot of damage. For example, Tulsi Gabbard, when she came on board, created something called the Directors Initiative Group, the DIG, which was a bunch of individuals that were people who had worked with her, for her, she knew about, mm-hmm. and brought in. They weren't necessarily long-term career intel officials. And, you know, she's had them doing all of this work on politicization and quote-unquote weaponization. And I think she's had them going through Amelia Earhart files to see what can be declassified. I mean, it's an incredible array of tasks. They're the people who came up with these horrible lists of people that had their clearances pulled. Very shoddy staff work done in that regard. This week, they've announced that group's being disbanded.
Yeah.
But they're gonna spread them throughout the ODNI. It's not that they're not being disbanded and returned home or fired. They're being spread throughout the ODNI. So, as I was telling someone the other day, you know, you can rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. But, we all know how the story ultimately ends. So it's bad.
Sounds like the withdrawal from Minneapolis, the non-withdrawal withdrawal.
Now, one thing that came up today, Catherine Herridge did a report that says the ODNI has drafted a report about the anomalous health incidents, the Havana syndrome, it's called, and that it debunks and criticizes the analytic tradecraft of two or three previous ICAs that were done. And so I've got friends and colleagues who suffered from something, you know, they some serious medical conditions because of this. They're now getting excited about the fact that there's this report coming out of the ODNI that quote unquote debunks the tradecraft of some of the early reports. But it's a report that was done by the DIG. And I'm personally of the mind that I don't think I can trust anything coming out of the DIG, given some of the shoddy work that they've done in the past. And it's just not good to have the leader of the intel community and her immediate staff being people that fundamentally can't be trusted, that are fundamentally acting in a very political manner. If you track their social media, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, the deputy, a guy named Lucas, the guy who heads up NCTC, Joe Kent, the guy who heads up the National Counterintelligence and Security Center, and the Public Affairs Office of the ODNI, their social media is constantly putting out stuff that violates the Hatch Act up one side and down the other. They're making very political statements against the Biden administration, praising President Trump. This is unprecedented for the intel community to be acting in such a political manner.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, and once they start acting political, it just fundamentally eats away at the credibility of almost anything that then comes out, at least from that leadership level.
Sounds like we're back in the 70s again, and the CIA being raked over the call over the coals by the Church Committee. But anyway, we have to take a short break. We'll be back in just a second with Larry Pfeiffer. Okay, we're back.
Following up on your unprecedented, right? Like, what actually is going on? And to Jeff's point, is there some precedent? What is the precedent of the intelligence agencies having anything to do with election security?
So, you know, they had established a foreign malign influence center at the ODNI.
But that's gone, right?
It's gone, or the DNI will tell you that its activities have been assumed by existing elements of the organization.
Okay.
You know, they also, you know, cut the staff dramatically, and it's just hard to tell from the outside what exactly is happening inside. But, you know, they had the Foreign Malign Influence Center, which looked at what foreign intelligence organizations were doing to attack our elections, to try to influence the American people, et cetera. You had elements, you know, within the other agencies that would also feed into that or produce reporting on that. You had out on the margins of the intel community, you had CISA doing election integrity work. Mm-hmm. You had the FBI doing election integrity work. And then a place like NSA and Cyber Command, which are, you know, involved in, you know, looking at computers in the American government system, there are technical capabilities that can be brought to bear in a positive way to try to ensure that these voting machines and other aspects of vote counting, vote tabulation, voter registration rolls, that stuff is all being maintained. But those are things that are done in a cooperative fashion. You know, the state of Arizona would say, hey, DHS or FBI or CISA, we're worried about our machines. Can you guys come and help us? And part of that team that would then go to the state and help those people might include some people from NSA, the you know, people from the cybersecurity side of the house, not the intelligence production side of the house, going down and actually helping them. You know, going and seizing machines, seizing ballots, going to Puerto Rico and taking stuff away from there, again, seems, at least at face value, to be a little bit unusual.
I just wanted to jump in on one distinction that I think is important, and it leads to, I think, one of the sketchiest things that Tulsi Gabbard did as DNI. The distinction is between foreign malign influence, propaganda, disinformation, you know, cyber attacks to steal emails, all of which the Russians did in 2016, and the actual tinkering with ballots, you know, using, manipulating vote counts through cyber warfare or other means. Gabbard, in among her releases, I think, from The Dig, which mm-hmm. she made a lot of the fact that the intelligence community in the summer of 2016 told the White House that there was not evidence that the Russians were tinkering with the ballots or planning right. to manipulate the vote count. Of course, they were doing lots of other stuff in the foreign malign influence sphere right. that definitely made a huge impact. But Gabbard tried to pretend because the IC said that there was no tinkering of the ballots, therefore there was no Russian interference,
right.
which is like mind-bogglingly stupid. I mean, right. there were two different things.
Yeah. I mean, just about every declassification and public release she did last summer, the statements analyzing what she released didn't resemble what she actually released if you went and took the time to read them. It was a bizarre exercise in don't believe what you see, believe what I tell you is in these documents. Yeah.
So do you think this is the first of many, or counting Puerto Rico, are these the first two of many incidents you think we're going to see of trying to use election interference as a way of maybe upending the coming election?
Well, I think that's the fear. The fear is that they're going to have, people that they've contracted out, people they've hired to come in and review this material they got from Georgia, this material they got from Puerto Rico, and they're going to come up with conspiracy theories as to how that stuff was manipulated, which then will perhaps give them what they think they need to then act after the midterm election to go and seize ballots and seize voting machines in precincts where their candidates are not doing so well and claiming that it's happening there too. I think that's the fear people have.
So what's the way to prevent that from happening?
Well, I think there are some court cases proceeding in the state of Georgia. Fulton County is suing the government to, get the stuff back, saying that it was, overreach. So, perhaps there could be some victory in the court case. But, I think some of these other, if they opt to go and pursue this in other states like Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, or somewhere like that, perhaps being forewarned, they can act before the material is actually seized and taken away.
Wow.
I'm actually surprised Georgia wasn't able to get some judge to stop them from taking that stuff away the day it actually happened.
One of the really big questions is why the magistrate signed off on that affidavit, because if you read it closely, there's no probable cause ever identified. It's, suspicious activity committed by persons unknown to right. the FBI that, if it was intentional, would constitute a crime, but there's no evidence that it was intentional.
Yeah,
they couldn't identify a single instance or complainant.
A fishing expedition, absolutely. So that's why some people think that they'll prevail in the courts and they'll be able to get all that stuff back. But the DNI and their contractors and their staffs are going through it as we speak. I don't believe they've been stopped from looking at it, have they?
That's a very interesting question. She did say in her letter to Congress that she brought officials from the National Counterintelligence Center mm-hmm. and Security Center down with her mm-hmm. to the to Fulton County. But I would think that the FBI's, rules on what gets distributed, I don't know whether DNI could get access to that kind of stuff.
And again, getting back to how credible of an institution the ODNI is, it wouldn't surprise me if they just made stuff up that we wouldn't be able to prove because they hold the material and we can't then go and review it again to see what they're claiming.
Larry, I'm wondering what you hear from your former Confederates, your colleagues mm-hmm. in the intelligence community. You run the Hayden Center at George Mason University. You circulate among your old buds and all mm-hmm. very high-ranking people, and you have interfaces with students at George Mason and so on. I'm wondering what you're hearing about what can be done from your side of the ledger. Can our intelligence folks, ex-intelligence folks, talking about responding to this really alarming development? Or are you feeling, this is really inside baseball here, that you all got burned by that Hunter Biden laptop full-page ad you took out in the New York Times? You got whacked by MAGA World on that. What can the intelligence professionals do? Do you guys have enough credibility to confront this kind of craziness and alarming developments going on?
Well, I don't think our credibility has been impugned to anyone other than the small select crowd that believes what Donald Trump and his immediate compadres are saying. So the fact that they've attacked me and others like me, most of us consider it a badge of honor. We must be doing something right if they feel like they've got to come after us. And there are many people who actually will look to us for explanations because they've been attacking us. We must be a threat to them if they're feeling like they need to attack us. So that really doesn't bother me. Well, I mean, it does bother me, but I don't believe our credibility is being eaten away at all. What are we doing? Well, a number of us have, you know, formed groups. I belong to something called the Steady State that you all are probably familiar with. It's a group of about 400
Steve Cash on,
former senior intelligence officers who are making it our mission to go out and explain how things that are happening with this administration, things that are happening in America, are very reminiscent of what we have all seen in our foreign intelligence missions through our careers, what we have seen happen in countries that have slid into authoritarianism or are acting in an authoritarian manner or are led by authoritarian leaders. And all we can do is just keep drumming that message home. We've gotten a lot of traction. You know, we're out on social media on every platform. We do podcasts. We put out something we've done a couple of times is we are actually writing products that look and sound like intelligence community assessments. They use the tradecraft and the language of intelligence community assessments, looking at what's happening in America today and assessing it with as impartial an eye as we can. So I encourage folks to go. We're on Substack. We're on, you pick the social media. We're there, and we're working very hard to do it. So that's one group. There are others who are doing this through their own means, their own podcasts, their own social media, getting on television. We're doing the best we can to try to get the message out and kind of keep in our lane and talk about the concerns we have as intelligence professionals about what's happening to our intelligence community, but about what's happening to how we're governed.
Let me ask you a little bit about that tradecraft. You guys are among you. There are a number of experts on black propaganda, mm-hmm. the kind of messages that resonate. When you brought up tradecraft, so I'm curious about what you mean by that.
Well, in that regard, I was kind of talking about analytic tradecraft, you know, people who are who have been trained to take a rational look at a problem set, to weigh all the evidence, to protect against different kinds of biases when examining evidence, and then making analytic judgments with varying levels of probability. And so that's what I meant by tradecraft there.
Okay.
Yeah, we're not out there creating misinformation or propaganda to try to influence the American people. We believe we're shedding the light to show the truth about what's going on.
Now, there are ongoing investigations into your former colleagues in intelligence community. We know about one in South Florida where mm-hmm. James Clapper got a subpoena. John Brennan is supposed to be under the floodlights. Do you know of people, I mean, other than big names like that, who have been caught up in these investigations and, you know, gotten subpoenas, had to hire lawyers, concerned about what might be coming down the pike?
Yes, there are many of us who have lawyers hired. I mean, I've got a lawyer who's generously doing it pro bono for me. Fortunately, I have not been, I was subpoenaed a few years ago with regard to the Hunter Biden laptop by Jim Jordan's subcommittee on weaponization. And I provided him a bunch of documents and I had nothing to hide and they never came and talked to me, which was fine by me. There are several of us who have, I know some people who have been subpoenaed to appear at the in front of the grand jury in Florida, in the case you mentioned.
Do you know when they're supposed to testify? When the
I do not. For as many as I know who've been subpoenaed, there are many others who have not gotten a subpoena yet, which has surprised them, given what they had heard this court was going to be doing. There are many who are, you know, sitting there going, God, I thought I was going to get a subpoena and have to deal with this. And in some cases, nothing's happening.
Well, not to fuel conspiracy theories, but there's one that has kind of come to my attention that might explain some of what's going on. It was curious to a lot of people that the U.S. attorney overseeing the case in Fulton County is a guy by the name of Tom Albus, who's the U.S. attorney in St. Louis in Missouri.
Right.
Why would the chief prosecutor in Missouri be overseeing a case in Fulton County? And one theory that has come up is, and actually it seems to be a fairly good one, is that Dominion, the company that was maligned falsely for manipulating votes, supposedly having been planted by Hugo Chavez in Venezuela years earlier through Smartmatic, which then made its way to Dominion. Dominion was bought by a Canadian company, was bought by a company in St. Louis. Huh. So that could explain, you know, why Albus is doing this, and he's going to go back at Dominion, which won how many millions of dollars from Fox because they propagated these conspiracy theories. And one really wild element to that, I'll just throw it out there, is they need evidence from a Venezuelan official that might somehow corroborate these crazy ideas about Dominion. Is Maduro going to be approached about making a deal to provide evidence to back up the wacky conspiracy theories about Dominion and he'd be let off the hook?
I mean,
nothing's impossible.
The sad thing is that that's something we kind of seriously ponder. Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask a question about intelligence, the intelligence community overall and mm-hmm. the future, which is that we're all focused on these appointments that seem like professionals that don't have the right training on deals that are making behind the scenes, on interpretations and analysis that we don't know if we can trust. Are we safe? I think of the intelligence community as being able to focus on threats that are actually coming and how we can analyze that information to know how to protect ourselves. Do you fear that there are weaknesses, or do you think business can go on as usual despite all of these other developments?
So what I would say is, you know, the U.S. intelligence community, the enterprise that, you know, encompasses dozens of cabinet departments and thousands and thousands of people, is very, very large. And it's made up mostly of very good, very talented, very patriotic people, most of whom go to work every day and do the job they've been doing, you know, for their whole career. And I think the vast majority of intelligence is still being produced and is still churning its way through the system, and it's chugging along fine. You know, that being said, though, when, you know, the leadership of your agency, you know, and I think of a place like CIA, or I think of a place like NSA that's been rudderless with, you know, for the better part of a year, you know, agencies whose senior lawyers have been swapped out and MAGA lawyers have been put in, that can begin to color and taint what may be coming out of those agencies, the direction the people may be being given. You begin to worry that, you know, your best and brightest may, traditionally the best and brightest people run to the light. They go to the hard problems because that's how they're going to advance their career and do great things. But you know, those hard targets often tend to be the controversial ones. You know, so there may be some people who have decided, hey, you know, maybe I don't want to go be in the spotlight during this administration. So, you know, maybe I'll take a sabbatical. Maybe I'll go work some obscure target set for a while, for the next couple of years until this blows over. We definitely have lost talent. I mean, the exit door out of the Intel community, barely has time to shut as people stream out of that place. I think we've lost thousands of people that I think were eligible to retire, but would not have retired otherwise, who have now left. We have lost a lot of younger people who say, "Hey, I'm early enough in my career that I'm not hooked to this place. I can get out of here and go work for, Meta or Google or, some open source intelligence enterprise and have a nice career ahead of them without having lost a significant pension or, years of vetting towards a pension." So we've lost those. The freeze in hiring that took place for the better part of the last year, the letting go of provisional employees as they did in the early days, that's a chunk of talent that isn't coming in the door now. And I will tell you, you talked about, my engagement with students. 3 years ago, my conversations with students were, "Hey, Mr. Pfeiffer, please tell me what can I do to distinguish myself, to make myself more competitive so I can get that job at CIA or at NSA or the FBI. Now the question invariably, if I get asked, is it a good time or should I just maybe go work somewhere else for a while and consider the Intel community later? So that's the tone of the students at the moment. And those are the ones who are coming forward. There are probably plenty of them who just have made their decision. This isn't the time to go. Or because of the freezing of the hiring, when things are frozen, you got to go somewhere else. And once somebody lands in a private corporation making good commercial money, it's real hard to turn around a year or two later and say, maybe I'll take a cut in a significant cut in pay to go do my patriotic duty to work at CIA. And so we lose talent, and it's a shame.
You say we have lost thousands of good people. That's frightening.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you look at across the enterprise, absolutely.
Is there a way to document that? How do we know?
Well, I think some of it's been documented through through some of the releases that have come from the Intel community. But another thing that happened, this just a minor little story, but NSA had a great program where if you retired, you could be rehired back on as a special government employee, as an annuitant, where you would be getting your retirement money, but you would also be getting paid somewhat close to what you were being paid when you left, and you would be kept on as somebody with knowledge and experience that could help train and bring along the new generation of folks.
And also be called off the bench for ad hoc assignments where you have a particular specialty.
It was a great program. A nice, easy transition for friends who weren't quite ready for retirement, but because you work usually like 20 hours a week or so many hours a year. It really was a wonderful program. And NSA, to get down in the weeds, the way the hiring worked, we had a lot of hiring in the Reagan years. And then when the wall fell, hiring, went off the cliff, and it went off the cliff for about a decade until 9/11 happened. And then it went gangbusters again. So there was a significant demographic trough at NSA. That had people very worried. HR people and managers were figuring out ways to work that problem, because you couldn't have a whole generation people my age suddenly retire and then have a 10-year gap of experience. So the NSA put a lot of energy into this retiree program. Well, when the DOGE cuts and all that happened in the early part of this this administration, NSA was able to by getting rid of that program, they were able to count those positions against the positions that they were being asked to cut. And so a lot of my friends and colleagues were like, "Well, hey, as much as I'd like to keep working and having fun at NSA on a part-time basis, I'd rather go ahead and I won't get upset about being cut if it saves the job of some younger person who still has a career ahead of themselves and has kids in school and they're paying mortgages and all that stuff." And so NSA pretty much gutted that program in the early part of this year, got rid of a lot of great experience and talent amongst these retirees. So it's fascinating how it kind of all played out. But in the end, as I said, it kind of eats away at experience, expertise, knowledge. People are a little bit afraid, a little bit timid. You hear stories in the press, at least. I can't confirm them directly, but you hear stories about legal interpretations being kind of forced down into the agency with regards to covert operations and things of that nature. And so, you're an officer at an intelligence agency, and your lawyers are now telling you that it's legal to go do this. How do you argue that point?
Senator Wyden made public his note to John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, that he wanted to hear more. He wanted an answer back about current CIA operations. Do you have any idea what that's about?
No, I don't. God bless Senator Wyden. He is a passionate man. More often than not, he's passionate about intelligence operations that could impinge on civil liberties. So my initial thought would be, if he's concerned about something, that's kind of what he's normally been concerned about. So maybe there's something going on at CIA that he worries is impinging
domestic
on
intelligence
civil liberties. But there's a lot that CIA has been involved in, if you believe what has been written in the press, that, could raise the questions of Senator Wyden. And, and again, you get back to Senator Wyden sent the letter. What did CIA do? The Public Affairs Office put out a statement attacking the senator. My experience is that is never the wisest thing in the world to do, because you never know when that senator is going to be in the majority again. And even in the minority, a senator can, make your life a little bit less than pleasant going forward. So
it's the Pam Bondi model.
And, when I was a CIA, I was chief of staff, we would sit at the morning staff meeting and we'd go around the table and, invariably you'd get to the ledge affairs guy and he would say, "Oh, hey, we got a letter in from Senator Wyden." And, the whole table would go, "Oh God, what's this?
I love him.
That would never leave the room. We would never say to the public affairs guy, or the ledge affairs guy, "Go attack Senator Wyden." No, what we would do is we'd kind of have that side, but then a guy like General Hayden, who I worked for, would go, "Hey guys, this is why we have congressional oversight. If 9 out of 10 times he raises a question, it ends up being stupid, dumb, whatever. But maybe there's that 1 time out of 10 he raises a concern that, maybe we should take a second look at what we're doing." And so that's why we have the system we have. And so, as much as it can aggravate you when you get a letter like that at face value, you got to step back and say, "Well, this is the system we have, and this is the system we have for very good reason." There are a lot of important checks and balances on, again, this very secretive, very powerful enterprise that is the intelligence community. And my experience is most intelligence leaders at the highest level welcome that scrutiny, and not just from Congress. We welcome it from the press, too. I mean, believe me, there were times the press would drive us crazy. You guys in particular.
That often doesn't convey.
But when we would have a staff meeting, again, morning staff meeting, and it wouldn't be unusual at all for General Hayden at the end of a meeting to say, "Okay, is there anything anybody is doing right now that if it made the front page of the Washington Post, we would all be freaking out." And, that would sometimes surface some things that, were worth taking a look at.
A lot of people looking at their shoes.
Yeah.
Well, with that sweet walk down memory lane, we're going to have to leave it there. And that's a sweet memory of things being normal. And hopefully the wheel will turn. And we'll be out of this nightmare soon. Larry Pfeiffer, thanks so much for coming on the Spy Talk podcast again. You're a great guest, and it's always great to have you.
Always fun.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
You know that wellness goal you set at the start of the year? It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. With 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and more. No fillers, no nonsense, just the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code NEWS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava.com, code NEWS.